According to my guest today, we have three types of crimes: stupidity, aggravated stupidity, and capital stupidity. We might cover all three today. From licking toilet seats to shutting down church services, the law has seen it all this week. And people have questions. I have questions. Can the government really order me to stay home? Is picking up dog crap from my front yard really an essential service? And who in the heck is licking toilet seats? And please tell me we're not related. Well, we will try to unpack some of these legal issues with coronavirus in this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am excited to announce a new venture we will be doing with these podcasts during this quarantine to kind of help us get through this quarantine, I guess by taking our mind off of issues. But Mackenzie Smith, she has been on this show before. I interviewed her. She was the aviator lawyer, still is the aviator lawyer, though apparently there's not a lot of aviation law going on right now, but she has agreed to do a special series of podcasts involving movie reviews. So we are going to watch a movie every week, or as often as we can find the time to do, and well, let's face it, we have time on our hands right now. We are going to be watching a movie, then unpacking it every week from a legal perspective, and also from just the perspective of people watching and enjoying movies. The first movie we are going to unpack for you is My Cousin Vinny. That's right, we're going to start right off at the very top, the best legal movie ever made. Who is not a big fan of My Cousin Vinny? The answer would be no one. And so if you want to watch it as well, watch My Cousin Vinny in the next week. Mackenzie and I will unpack this movie from a legal perspective. Well, today I have several guests on, and we are going to try to unpack the legal issues with the coronavirus. We are all under the quarantine now, the stay-at-home order, unless you provide an essential service. You have to stay at home, which does beg the question, what is an essential service? Now, I live on a golf course, and yesterday there were golf carts running through my backyard all day long. Now, true, it was a very nice day, but apparently golf is an essential service. This is precedent that we can surely use after this pandemic passes. In the past, playing golf during the weekday was kind of like skipping work, but now we'll just be engaging in an essential service. Now, I am ashamed to admit this next point, but it is true. I hire someone to pick up dog crap out of my front yard. I have two strapping boys, and yet we see it necessary to hire someone else to pick up dog crap out of our front yard. Now, why do we do this? Do we not know what dog crap is? Yeah, it's a fertilizer. It helps the lawn turn green. But apparently, we need it removed from our front yard so that we can hire another company to come and lay down the fertilizer. Yeah, sometimes I just simply do not get our economy or my role in it, but apparently I do love to stimulate the economy as I hire someone to pick up dog crap from my front yard. All right, but here's why I'm telling you this story now. Apparently, picking up dog crap out of one's front yard, that is an essential service. So if your job has been deemed an unessential service, if you're sitting at home with nothing to do because your job is not an essential service, just think you picked the wrong line of work. Well, some of these orders have not been consistent. These stay-at-home orders, for example, Hobby Lobby was ordered to shut down last week. To the dismay of women everywhere, I am sure, but Hobby Lobby is not an essential service. But liquor stores are. Seriously? Because I gotta tell you, I think the two are connected. The more time you spend on those dang craft projects, the more one is driven to drink. I'm just saying I don't know how or where these laws of essential services are being drawn. But we're going to try to unpack the legal issues of when can the government shut you down and order you to your room? How long can this go on? Did our founding fathers have anything to say about licking toilet seats? We are going to interview Michael Thompson, and then later on, we're going to interview Jesse Payne on the legal issues with the coronavirus. Well, this week we have a special guest, Michael Thompson. Michael, it's good to have you.
Thank you, Joel. It's good to be with you.
Now, you have been on before, but for those of you who have not heard the previous podcast, you are an interesting person. You are general counsel for the General Church of the Nazarene. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Now, I got to tell you, general counsel, that is a cushy job. In law school, that is what we all aspire to be. One day, maybe we can reach the nice, lofty, perky status as general counsel where you don't have to do any work. Is that a fair characterization, or am I off just a bit?
Oh, there are some days where that might be the case. There are other days when I wish I could be a specialist once again. The days where it's rough are when you are kind of expected to know everything about everything.
Yes, of course.
The nice days are when you have the flexibility to refer it off to others.
Yes, you have to know all areas of law because you deal with a ton of stuff. So, of course, I was just joking somewhat. It's not a lofty, comfy, do-nothing position. It is a very interesting position. Now, I have another friend who's a general counsel. She came to one of my classes in Knoxville, Tennessee. She was the general counsel of Bristol Motor Speedway. Now, I had to think that would be a great job to have. She told me one time her job duties as a general counsel required her. They were doing some big event there that's going to be the biggest football game ever in North America. I believe it's Tennessee versus some other, Virginia Tech, I believe it was. And so you had 150,000 fans there at this place, and they needed someone out there to hold the flag. And so she had to go out there as general counsel and hold the flag because, well, someone had to do it. Why not the general counsel? Do you ever get called in to those kind of tasks?
I wish I did. I think I'm actually more qualified to hold a flag than some of the things that I actually try to do.
I want to get your perspective on the coronavirus as a general counsel, but then also you are a pastor, and so you are involved with large gatherings. But before we get there, I want to get your perspective on some local legal cases percolating out there, because that's what we do on a weekly basis. I try to cover the crazier side of the law. And for you listeners, let me just tell you and come clean, I probably get half my cases from Michael. For some reason, Michael, you have your thumb on the crazier side of the law, and I get half my cases from you. So you must have an interesting practice.
Yeah, I seem to stumble across those. And fortunately, most of them I can refer over to you that they are ones that I'm not actually involved in. But it is nice to get something that can make you smile in the course of the day.
Yeah, no, I think you're like me. As we scour through Facebook or over the internet and some crazy case we read about, we're thinking, okay, yeah, that's my practice. That's what I do. And so now, in light of that, let me tell you two interesting cases that I found this last week. You must have been too busy this last week to see them first. Maybe you did see them, but I want your opinion on these cases because, listeners, Michael also used to be a prosecutor. He would prosecute you for committing malfeasance, and he's the kind of person that you would normally be fearful of. He can control your freedom, your destiny. So, Michael, let me give you these cases. I learned that there is this guy in Missouri who recently was arrested for licking produce at Walmart. He apparently wanted to speak out against the coronavirus, and so he took a picture of him licking produce at Walmart. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
I saw something about that in the news today, not in Missouri, but I think down in Georgia, where the grocery store had to throw away something like $60,000 worth of produce because people were going and intentionally sneezing on it.
What is wrong with the world where people are licking produce that other people are going to buy? Apparently, also this guy licked. He ran his tongue across a row of deodorants at a store shelf and then posted that on Facebook or social media for the rest of the world to see. It gets a little bit worse here. Maybe you saw this reference too, but one TikTok personality decided to take some footage of him licking a toilet bowl. I don't even know what to say about that. What would you do, Michael, if you were a prosecutor and you learned that someone within your jurisdiction was licking toilet bowls?
I used to say when I was a prosecutor that the law could be broken down, the criminal law could be broken down into three categories, stupidity, aggravated stupidity, and capital stupidity. Now, the licking a toilet seat, if it was his own, that's one where I just think that's weird. And but if he's coming over and licking my toilet seat, that's at least aggravated stupidity.
That's aggravated stupidity, all right. Dare I ask, what would rise to the level of capital stupidity?
Oh, that would be a whole podcast for you of some of the ones I've dealt with.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, one of these days, listeners, just teasing you, one of these days we'll finally hear all about the crazy cases a prosecutor has to deal with. Though I can't imagine anything dumber than licking toilet seats in public during the corona. Well, I don't even care if it's not during the coronavirus time. At any point in time, licking toilet seats just should not be allowed. Well, this might surprise you. Now, let me just put you on the spot here first. This is not really putting you on the spot, but I'm just curious. You were a prosecutor. What would be the crime that you would charge that person with?
For the toilet seat or for the produce?
Well, either one.
The toilet seat, again, unless it's a toilet seat in Home Depot that's for sale or something like that, I have difficulty seeing a crime. If it's just his individual toilet seat, maybe if he's licking it and then going around and shoving it in people's faces, that would be assault or aggravated assault. The produce, at the very least, that is that's got to be criminal damage to property, potentially inciting unrest or disorderly conduct. I see that in the news. I just read the headline. I didn't get into the story, but there's some talks about how. People who do that could be charged as committing an act of terrorism.
Yes, that's what I saw.
I don't know if I would. I just don't know. The closest I ever came to having to deal with this sort of stuff was back during the Y2K scare. And we were preparing for what would happen if everything did shut down at midnight on New Year's. Now, fortunately, that didn't happen.
But, right, right.
People were getting somewhat crazy at that time. But nothing like this.
Oh, I remember that. So on Tuesday of this past week, U.S. Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen suggested that anyone caught intentionally spreading the novel coronavirus could face charges under federal terrorism laws because it meets the statutory definition of a biological agent. And so a man in Missouri, Cody Lee Pfister, 26, of Wharton, has been charged with making a terrorist threat after allegedly recording a video of himself mentioning the coronavirus and then licking several items in a Missouri Walmart. He was taken into custody by local police on Monday after a video of the stunt surfaced on social media. I don't even know what to say. So why don't we just segue from that into what are you doing as both a pastor? So you are normally in charge of large events where people gather. And also you are general counsel of an international church, the Church of the Nazarene. How are you preparing and handling the coronavirus? Let's just start there.
Well, it's been all consuming because I missed the day in law school and I missed the day in seminary where they covered how to deal with global pandemics. So I've been scrambling, just trying to figure out what's going on.
You know what, maybe we should change our law school offerings. Maybe we should cover toilet seat licking and pandemic responses. But hey, that's for the future.
I would have signed up for that one.
You would have signed up. All right. Go on. I'm sorry.
So then with the laws that are coming out on a daily basis, that's been a challenge as well, scrambling to figure out what those mean.
What do you mean laws that are coming out on a daily basis?
Well, the FFCRA, Family First Coronavirus Relief Act, I think is what that is. It expanded coverage from the Family Medical Leave Act to give mandatory coverage for sick pay, for time off, for caring for family members or for yourself. That's been a challenge because we as a church have been exempt from many of those provisions of Family Medical Leave Act. Most of our local churches would be small enough where they do not, where they've been exempt from that. But all of a sudden they changed the rules where now our churches do have to comply with at least provisions of the FFCRA.
So the thought there is if you do take sick leave because of the coronavirus, the law has now recently changed where employers have to cover them, even employers that recently were exempt from this requirement.
Correct.
Interesting.
And the benefit to employers, for the most part, has been a payroll tax credit. And just navigating that is a challenge because pastors are treated differently for tax purposes. Pastors are treated differently in as it relates to a lot of human resources law. And the way that you usually figure out what these laws mean are by looking at the what the judges say.
But right.
This stuff is brand new, and it needs to be applied right now. So fortunately, everybody, all of my counterparts with other denominations are in the same boat. So we have been burning up each other's emails and our online discussions, sharing ideas and experiences and resources, trying to figure it all out.
Now, you're talking a lot about employment situations. How do we handle people who want sick time, need to take time mm-hmm. off because they are sick? And definitely that's going to require some sort of struggle. But what about, and this one is of particular interest to me since I am a constitutional lawyer, these requirements, these orders to stay at home and to disband. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know where I fall on this as just a human being. But sometimes where I fall as a human being is not where I fall as a lawyer. You know, something might appall me as a lawyer, whereas as a human being, I'm thinking that does make a little bit of sense. But how are you handling the orders to disband and not meet, especially since you deal with people all over the globe?
Yeah, really good questions, because ordinarily when we see these kind of orders going out, it is not within the United States. It's in police states. And so the church has historically had to figure out how to continue to be the church, even when civil law says you cannot do the things that you traditionally associate with being a church.
Right.
When these orders started coming down within the United States, it was very disconcerting. I had many of the same concerns that you're expressing, Joel, looking at it from what does this mean from First Amendment standpoint, not only in terms of restricting freedom of religion, the right of the people peaceably to assemble. These things are all very much in my mind. But then we want to be... the last thing any church leader wants to do is take action that's going to jeopardize the health or safety of the people under their care. the position we have taken, our leaders have recommended that our churches follow the directives of the government at this time, not necessarily out of any kind of surrender, but certainly not out of any kind of surrender of our rights, but more out of the biblical mandate to love others, to treat others as better than yourself, and recognizing that at this point there's a serious public health concern. So out of compassion for those who are at risk and out of compassion for those who are first responders and medical providers, we are doing whatever we can as a church to support them and help them during this time.
Now, from a legal standpoint, I can tell you, I was fascinated by a story I read this morning. I don't know if you caught it, but in Texas, I believe it was the Texas governor who ordered Planned Parenthood to stop offering abortions during this time period. And Planned Parenthood has sued Texas, saying that order to shut them down is illegal. And the reason why I find this fascinating is it's a dangerous precedent to set. During this time when government is ordering people to shut down, if they are wrong and you can sue the government over that, there's going to be a lot of businesses who say, you know what, you shut us down and you allowed all these other businesses to stay open. I never survived. I lost my dream, my livelihood. You're going to see a plethora of lawsuits. And so how the court handles this one brought by Planned Parenthood could be a precedent that applies to all businesses across America. Now, I can just guess in the Planned Parenthood case, the court might say, well, you have some kind of extra constitutional right to stay open, but whatever they say is the standard is then going to be applied across the board across the United States. Any just initial thoughts on that?
I was listening to the oral argument in the Supreme Court case that's pending right now on abortion, and the emphasis seemed to be from the medical standpoint as to whether it was appropriate to require an abortion provider who is registered with or admitted to a certain hospital, and the justices were focusing their questioning on the medical aspect of it. And I wonder if this were to end up being litigated, if that's the direction it would go, since all of the emergency orders have pretty much exempted medical care from any of the stay-at-home stuff. It's a protected category. I wonder if it'll go there. I keep meaning, once I have time, to go back and start and do some more research about during the Civil War when President Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, and there were a number of challenges in the courts during that time. My memory is that they basically pushed pause on resolving any of this stuff until the Civil War was over. And then once it was over, the courts, in some cases, came and said, yeah, you couldn't do that. That was wrong. But since habeas corpus has been restored, it's now moot, and there's nothing further that has to be done. If my memory is right on that, then I think that would be the precedent and what we would end up seeing.
Well, this is definitely unprecedented time. Who knows what the future is going to hold? My own personal thoughts would be the American public is very patient. We are very industrious. We are willing to do whatever it takes. And so they'll sit still and quiet for 30 days and really however long it takes. But much beyond 30 days, people are going to want to start to see some evidence and some reasons why they are being forced to stay at home and give up their livelihood. But I guess we'll have to play this day by day because who knows what tomorrow holds. Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming on today. As always, I appreciate your insight and keep the crazy cases coming my direction. I really appreciate them.
Glad to do so. I will do that. And it's good talking with you.
Well, this week I have as my guest Jesse Payne, attorney and podcaster extraordinaire from the country music capital of the world, one of my favorite places to be, Nashville, Tennessee. Jesse, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Now, Jesse, I introduced you as being from Nashville, but you also are from my neck of the woods, Kansas. You grew up here. Did you grow up in Kansas?
Did. Born and raised.
All right. What part?
Down South Central, down in Wichita.
Okay. Wichita. And that's kind of, I think I met you in Johnson County, yep. Kansas City area. And so we, I think even litigated a case together, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Down in Wichita, we did.
That's right. We won that case.
You won that case. You did a great job.
That's right. And I remember that case because after we won, the judge invited us back to his chambers and offered us all a shot of whiskey. Really? Is that how they do law down there in Wichita? That the judge just brings back all sides and just kick your legs up and have a couple shots of whiskey? But that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't remember that part. So you must have been a solo invitation for you.
Well, you know, or that, or you partook too much. I don't know which way this one cuts, but no, actually, I think a good friend of mine, Dale Schoengert, was also there for that, and he is a good, strong Catholic, so he probably drank for everyone. Well, nonetheless, let's get moving on. A couple of issues here today that I want to talk about with you, since you are a lawyer. Of course, the big item in the news that everyone is talking about, and so I'm sure it has not escaped your attention, there are no sports on TV. Jesse, what are we going to do? There's no sports.
There's a lot of replays going on now. I mean, my daughter was just spending the morning watching different replays of hockey all-star games. She's that desperate. So
wow. I'm with her. I've been sitting in front of a blank TV just staring. March Madness should be on right now. My KU Jayhawks would be, well, they'd be
They would have been out the first round. This is the best way that they can stay in for the long haul. It's just by canceling the whole thing.
That is right, because we know we would have won, and that's a lot better than having it being proven otherwise. Isn't there a saying like that? Was it Winston Churchill? Someone who said it is better to be thought a fool than to open up your mouth and remove all doubt?
Yes, that was, yep.
Yeah, so I can see a little bit of that for KU. It's like, we were assumed to have won, we would win the national championship, and so now you can't prove us wrong because we didn't have a chance to flop in the first round.
Yep.
All right, so what are you doing down there in Nashville to survive this, I don't know if we call it, pandemic, apocalypse, whatever it is? How are you surviving?
We are actually pretty shut down here in this area. It's hitting us pretty hard, actually. But we are taking advantage of, you know, getting outside, spending more time together as families. And we were just out on a walk here last night, and it was like all these families are out either walking or sitting in front of their house or just spending time together outside. It was actually, it's pretty fun to see how it's kind of almost bring people together and doing things that they probably would not do otherwise. Well, so
let's unpack that just a bit. Are you guys under a lockdown, some kind of governmental order requiring you to not go to work except for essential businesses?
There is one in the surrounding areas, yes.
Okay, we have that here in Kansas. Now, I want to just analyze that, and it's going to be a great segue to talking about legally what can be done, and we are both lawyers. Here's my thought. The governor of Kansas issued this order shutting everything down but essential businesses. I have learned there are a lot of essential businesses out there. For example, golf courses. There's a golf course that runs right through my backyard, and there were nonstop golf carts all day yesterday. Apparently, golfing is an essential business. Do you see something similar like that in Nashville?
Well, we don't have any golf courses around here, but yes, just the definitions of what is and what is not an essential business is pretty amazing. I mean, liquor stores. Obviously, liquor stores are part of the category of an essential business.
So really?
They are live and kicking, yes.
So you got to have your liquor, apparently.
What else are you going to do unless you're holed up besides either drink or go play golf?
Well, if you're going to play golf, you got to do something. So I imagine the cigar stores also are open.
Yeah, probably.
It is crazy. This has to be the craziest one, Jesse. I have found out my wife has this service that we pay money to. I'm not going to tell you how much money we pay every month because, quite frankly, it would be an embarrassment to admit. But we pay money every month for someone to come to our house and clean up the dog crap from the front yard. Have you heard of such a thing?
No.
Yeah,
I haven't.
Yeah, we pay good hard money every month for someone to come to my house and pick up the dog crap in the front yard. Guess what?
Isn't that what kids are for?
That's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought. But you want to know what? Under the Kansas law, that is an essential service, and they allowed to continue picking up dog crap from my front yard. So, Jesse, I have no idea what it means to be a non-essential service.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes I think that the government doesn't know what an essential business, because I heard that they accidentally shut themselves down when they passed this law because they were shutting down non-essential businesses, and all of a sudden the government just stopped working.
That's right. Hey, you know what? If you're a non-essential employee, go home. Boom, government shut down. I like that. That actually plays in quite well. Well, as a lawyer, I just can't help but think there might be some lawsuits after this. I mean, legally, can the government order you to stay home and when the consequence is you're going to lose your business?
And I think that a lot of that's going to turn on how this all turns out. You know, does it end up being worse than what they're thinking? Is it going to be better than what they're thinking? You know, it can be argued both ways. If it turns out that it's not as bad as what the projections have been, people are going to say, well, it wasn't as bad, so why did you force me to shut down? Well, the counter argument would be, it wasn't as bad because we did force you to shut down and we kept people away from each other. But yeah, I have a feeling that it's going to, turn on that.
Well, let's analyze that. So let's say someone comes to our office. Let's say you and I are partnering together. It's going to be the Payne and Oster Law Firm. Actually, I kind of like that. We help solve your pain, get rid of your pain. Oh, I tell you what, you got a great name there. I like it.
Yeah.
Maybe Joel Osteen and Jesse Payne.
Osteen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just say we have our own law firm. We have our shingle out there. Someone comes to our office and says, hey, my business was just shut down. I lost it. This is my career goal. My life, poured all my life savings into it. The governor ordered me to shut it down for 2 months, and I went belly up. I did not survive, and so they want to seek some kind of legal recourse. How would we go about analyzing that case? Would we take that case?
I don't know if it'd be worth the money, honestly. You know, because really, I think there's a rational basis in shutting things and getting people to not congregate.
Okay, so you jump right to the standard. And listeners, if you're not lawyers, almost every time the government takes some action that violates your rights in some way, there's going to be a standard of review that's going to be applied. And Jesse just mentioned rational basis, which means does the government have a rational basis for what they did? There are some other levels of scrutiny, like strict scrutiny, where the government has to have a compelling governmental reason, not just any reasonable basis, but a compelling reason. There's also some intermediate levels of review where it's somewhere between rational basis and strict scrutiny. So, Jesse, let's go there. Rational basis. Now, you would not apply rational basis to all decisions. Like, for example, right now, Planned Parenthood has sued the governor of Texas saying, hey, your order shutting down our abortion facilities violates, our right to a woman's right to privacy. So that would be a heightened standard of review that would be applied in that kind of case.
It all turns on whether or not you view whatever right is being infringed upon as a fundamental right. So is a right to work, right to have your own business, is that a fundamental right? Is it I write that, you know, that there only needs to be a rational basis for governmental intervention on. You know, it's, and I don't know if that question has ever been addressed as far as in terms of right to work laws. Right. That's more union specific, but.
And here is where the government is going to get themselves into trouble, I think. And because we're kind of analyzing this now on the right, but assuming we come up with some kind of right, however we phrase it, right to work, if it's in the Planned Parenthood context, it would be a woman's right to privacy. If it had been if it's a church, it'd be right to worship. We're going to somehow find ourselves a right. We're going to find a right. But then what if the governor is making exceptions? Like, for example, you can't do your business, but the guy who's picking up dog crap, he can do his business. They start playing favorites. And so now you go, how did you draw that line, Governor? And why did you draw the line where it cost me my business?
Yeah, that sounds like a little bit like discrimination to me.
It could, or favoritism. Let's say that one of the businesses that was not affected happened to, the owner donated money to the governor's campaign. There might be a little bit of favoritism going on there.
Anytime you make a decision that is including one, excluding another, it is by definition a discrimination. It's so whether it's legitimate discrimination, that's another story.
Now, I think you're right on that. What you said earlier, too, I think really hits the nail on the head, which is how will this play out? Because let's say this thing peters out. And there were some studies this week that shows the fatality rate might be more in line with the flu than what we have feared, because a lot more people have been infected than what we actually realize now, because we're not testing. If we had tested everyone, it might be tenfold the number that have been infected, which means the fatality rate is 10 times less than what we think. We should put it in line with the flu, but we don't know that now. But let's just say that plays out and that's what happens. Well, yeah, the government will be maybe justified in shutting things down for 30 days, but 60 days, but 90 days, 120 days. I mean, at some point in time, the government's actions are not going to be reasonable, and it will be an infringement. Where that line is drawn probably is going to be determined by how severe this ends up being. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, I think it is too early for us to say whether or not it will come out as not being an egregious governmental action or whether it is. It's all based on the end. And you got arguments both ways. You know, like I said earlier, if it turns out not to be that big of an issue as far as bad as what the government or what the experts were saying it was going to be, what's the reason for that? Is it because it by nature wasn't that bad, or was it because of the actions taken by the government caused it to not be bad?
Yeah, as long as the government's decisions aren't, they don't seem overreaching once they know. But once they get the information, I do believe at that point in time, they might be subjecting themselves to some liability. It's kind of hard because we don't know exactly. We're all in the dark here. And in fact, I think I can speak for pretty much everyone who has half a brain, where when we say that we hope we are wrong. I mean, I don't think this is as bad as what people are saying. But, you know, I think everyone's going to say, even those that predict the worst doomsday, we all hope to be wrong. We all hope it's a lot less than that. And that this 1 month off was an overreach, but because we just simply don't know, we're comfortable with this 1 month time period off. All right, Justin, let me give you this other story I just found today. There was this Maine island of North Haven. Have you ever been to Maine?
Yes.
In fact, I've been to Maine as well. A very pretty place. There are only two states in the entire United States I have not been to. That would be Rhode Island and Vermont. But nonetheless,
I have not been to Vermont. I have been through Rhode Island.
We'll see. All right, you got those two down. I need to go there. They voted to immediately ban visitors and seasonal residents to help stop the spread of COVID-19. So they actually are banning people who own houses there from going to their houses out of fear of COVID-19. What are your thoughts on that?
So the ban is for anybody, even residents can't even come back?
Right. If they're seasonal residents, only the permanent residents are allowed to be there. If you are in New York or in Florida and where these viruses are, you know, catching on, and it's obviously at a much higher rate than anywhere else in the United States, maybe except for New Orleans. These people said, we don't want you coming to your vacation home to get away from New York and bring the virus to us. In essence is what they are saying.
I've heard that Florida was thinking about something similar to that.
Wow. That is going to be a whole new area of law. If they are banning people from going to their house out of fear that person might bring a disease to their city.
And banning people from certain other parts of the country.
It's the one in Florida you're saying they're banning people from
New York.
Ah, okay.
I don't know if it's gone through yet, but I thought I had read a story that they were considering anybody that was coming from a hotbed. I think they were specifically referring to New York, I think New Jersey, which basically all the snowbirds that go to Florida from the Northeast weren't going to be able to go back.
Wow. That is fascinating. So here's how the law works in that regard. If you are going to sue for injunctive relief, in other words, you can bring a lawsuit in court, federal or state, really, and you can seek something like, I want access to my house. I want unconstitutional conduct to stop. So in other words, you're not seeking money. You're just seeking some kind of injunctive relief. Like, I want access to something, I want you to do something, or I want to be able to do something, or I want you to stop doing something illegal. So I would think that if these lawsuits were filed seeking injunctive relief, like, I want access to my house, they very well might be successful. If you are seeking damages, I think it'd be a totally different story, because then they would have immunity. And so are they, is the law clearly established in that regard? Probably not. We have not faced this.
We've not dealt with it.
No, not in the history of the United States. I can't even imagine a time we have dealt with something like this.
Was there anything, and I've not researched this, that has, say, back in the Spanish flu period back in like 1918, 1919, where there were legal challenges that arose out of any bans or any movement, travel, prohibitions that were put in place?
That's actually an interesting question. I'm gonna have to look up on Westlaw now, Lexis, to see if there were any bans back then or any lawsuits that were filed. I can't imagine that they were, but you don't know. I mean, that's that wasn't that what 100 years ago?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. You know what? You gave me some good homework for this week. Once they open up the law libraries, I can go and I can research that. But for the time being, I apparently might not have access to my Lexis Westlaw research. All right.
Well, that's an essential business. So
it is. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for coming on today, giving us your thoughts on the coronavirus. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess. Our marketing team of Redbird Solutions and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.